You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is December 7th, 2023 at 7:35 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And we talked last time about the holiday season being upon us and how that often causes us to interact with our family systems, and how at one end of that is the estrangement piece. But of course, at the other end is working if you don't already have a really functional, good relationship with your family, where you find that you're free to be yourself, you're free to be spontaneous, they respond to you in a way that's meaningful to you, and that you see them clearly, see what they have to offer you, and you go for that. One of the things about this human condition is that we really do want, at a very deep level, these caregivers that we had when we were children to see us and delight in us and to care about us. And if we can get that, it's valuable to have. It really is a settling experience. And if they have limitations, or, you know, I mean, all people have limitations, I really like to say we need to see the vulnerability, the lack of reliability, the difficulty of being in human relationships, and then we still have to form human relationships and depend on them seeing all of that clearly and not withdraw from them because there's not a level of perfection that we long for. And as you may recall in the attachment literature, the amount of time that a caregiver needs to show up for you in a good enough way is 30% of the time. So it's an astonishingly low bar. And relationships need to really, people need to show up good enough. They don't need to show up perfectly. Christian.
George, I'm going to aim right at 31% with my kids.
And they'll describe you as very generous, I'm sure.
He's an overachiever.
One of the differences, of course, between being a child and being an adult is you can articulate the things that you need. And you can, with your cognitive mind being developed the way that it is, so different from a child's mind, you can actually see people clearly, see who they are, understand them. One way to talk about this is narrative, understand the narrative, their narrative, and how well it matches to what you know about what happened, so that you have a sense of their ability to hold space, to see them clearly, and in seeing them clearly, see the things that they genuinely have to offer you, that and then parse it for what's meaningful to you, so that you can take up the things that have real meaning to you and not discount that or disqualify that because other things that you need, they don't really offer. When we're children, of course, we're dependent in a way on them providing most of the needs that we have. But as adults, that is not the case. And one of the ways in which you can find the value and accept what they have to offer in a genuine way that makes you feel good is by recognizing the things that they don't have, that they weren't able to give you, and go to people who can meet those needs in the way that they are now. You can't get the things that were not given to you in the past. We don't change the past by attempting to get in the present moment the things that we wanted from the past. We change the meaning of them by finding people who will meet those needs now and having the needs met, so we're not in a place of deprivation, not in a place of need. If you remember John Bowlby's, my favorite quote of John Bowlby's is, "You're only as needy as your unmet needs." And if you look at it from that perspective and you understand what it is that you do need, and you go and you find people who are willing to meet those needs, then that neediness goes away. One of the things that happens to people who have the perception of themselves as needing too much or being too demanding is really that in their early childhood situation, where the understanding of who you were was being reflected back to you from the caregiver, if your needs were overwhelming the caregiver, you might have had reflected back to you this idea that you needed too much, that you were too demanding, that you wouldn't settle. But that doesn't mean that those needs are inherently too much, or that you should abandon trying to get the things that you need now. It just means that in that circumstance, your caregiver wasn't actually able to take care of you in the way that you needed. I just want to close this door. Had you had a caregiver that matched those needs better, that had more resources, you might have been in expressing the same thing, had the reflection of delight, and then you would have had the experience of having those needs met, and you would have created a perception that I'm fine and my needs are reasonable. It's quite unusual, I think, for a child to cook up demands that are just outside of the possibility of human relationship. You know, we're talking about a child in relationship to a parent who is actually supposed to be in the position to provide the care. People have children for a lot of different reasons, and a lot of children grow up in homes where it wasn't exactly planned for them to come around. And one of the burdens that children often have placed on them is to provide meaning for the caregivers. Children are not a good substitute for exploration and finding meaning. And it is also a terrible burden to place on a child, for the child to provide the meaningfulness of a life. What's supposed to happen is that the caregivers are in a position to provide for a child and take care of the child in the way that the child needs. This is the nature of security. The child being seen and valued and delighted in and encouraged to explore the things that are meaningful to the child. What we notice in addiction and other complications of difficult childhoods is that when the child's needs are not met, and instead the parents' needs are met in the relationship. When you hit puberty, 10 or 12, something in there, or if you had a lot of chicken, 9, from the hormones that they inject in the chickens. Then as the cognitive mind develops, of course, you examine the deals that were made. And you reflect on them. Did the caregivers see you and value you and encourage you to do the things that were meaningful to you, that you were good at, or did they take care of themselves in that experience. And if you find that they took care of themselves at your expense, that epistemic trust shatters. So epistemic trust is where you believe somebody is telling you the truth, and you believe that the reason that they're telling you what they're telling you is so that it will be helpful to you. This is the basis of being open to learning from somebody. And so in childhood, of course, we're helpless in the beginning and then basically controlled by the authority of the caregivers. But as adolescence kicks in and our cognitive mind switches on, we can begin to evaluate that. If the epistemic trust shatters because the formation of cognitive thinking is not actually developed fully until your mid-20s, the early teen and mid-teen years, you can turn away from adults or authority figures, and in turning away from them, turn toward other kids who have had the same loss of trust. It becomes impossible to learn from adults, and so you turn to a peer group. The problem in doing that, of course, is that nobody is really thinking well. Nobody has a real experience of the adult world, and nobody really has a sense of the consequence of making boneheaded moves in the world. And so you may find that you make consequential decisions that aren't really well supported in terms of the thinking process, which can have unfortunate consequences. So, but you know, a lot of people come out of that process of adolescence and in examining the relationship with the caregivers, understand that actually they did provide good enough care. They did have the interests of the child in mind, and they do value the experience of that. And really what we wanted in that period of life is for the caregivers to help us negotiate the leaving behind of childhood and the entering into an adult world. There's a huge value for kids to preserve the epistemic trust and be able to rely on their caregivers and also on other adults that might be available to them to help them navigate it. The interest is in what the child is good at, what the child finds meaningful, and how that those components fit into the culture that we live in, and navigating the various bureaucratic systems that one needs to in order to move forward in achieving autonomy. Christian.
Do you see like the epistemic trust is mapping really well onto the different attachment strategies, or do you think it's more like particular relationship specific, or how would you relate those two ideas?
Well, in a simple sense, organized versus disorganized. Organized people, there is some sense of that. And in disorganized people, it's really pretty badly broken. And it also could be intact with one caregiver and not with another, depending on how the relationships go. And then the sense of the wider group of adults that are around you as you're a child growing up. Maybe epistemic trust will be intact with one or more of them outside of the immediate nuclear family. Sometimes, you know, there's a grandparent where the child can preserve the epistemic trust or some other valued person so that it's not a complete shattering at that time. But then sometimes it isn't that. There is, the resources are really restricted in terms of adult relationships that are available. So then it gets to be very specific as to what happened to you and whether you were able to preserve it or not. Intimate collaborative relationships, of course, the epistemic trust is there, and in transactional relationships, it may not be that level of trust. But in organized attachment, you're not fearful of great harm in terms of betrayals in relationships, whereas in disorganized land, the consequences of those betrayals is really experiences of life and death, which is quite different than the organized way. Dismissing people tend to think of mutual interest as the binder, and preoccupied people one of the main difficulties of preoccupied people is that they pretend to commit to relationships they don't actually commit. And so that's quite a bit different. But that's also different than that foundational epistemic trust.
Can you say more? What do you mean they pretend to commit to a relationship?
Well, preoccupied people have a tendency to present themselves in the way that they think you want them to present, so that you'll give them what they want. And so in a secure dynamic of relationship, if you make a commitment to somebody, you obligate the time, energy, and resources that are necessary to provide what you've committed to provide. And so you don't make that offer to other people because you recognize the limitation of the time, energy, and resources that are necessary to make that commitment to fulfill it. With preoccupied people, because they're pretending to make those commitments, they don't obligate the time, energy, and resources. And so they make the pretend commitments beyond what the resources would be to fulfill the obligations that they make, so that they don't follow through often on those obligations because they weren't actually intent on it. They were pretending to do it because that's what you wanted from them. It's not based on their own need. So that they're often overcommitted and don't follow through, or follow through in a not particularly good way. And they also don't monitor the dissatisfaction that comes from that in other people. Is that enough of, is that answering what you were asking? The way that it really strikes me mostly is if there's a conflict in the relationship, they're out really easily. And if you've actually made a commitment and obligated all this time, energy, and resources, it's mind-blowing that they can be out so fast. And then there's usually a litany of problems that have never been expressed over the course of the relationship that manifests in the final conversations. And it's quite surprising that they were never expressed before, but you also don't know whether they're true or not because they weren't expressed before. And that undermines the capacity to believe them. Christian?
George, can you contrast how that's different with the way an avoidant person would leave a relationship when they've like idealized and then devalued the person they're with?
So dismissing people tend to think of people being the way that they think about them being. And because they don't really have the capacity for empathy and they're not curious about other people particularly, it's only when you contradict their understanding of how it is that it occurs to them that it might not be the way that they think it is. They don't like to be alone, and they like to foster dependence of other people on them. But at the same time, the currency in that dismissing people use is idealization. So in a child who grows up to be dismissing, there is no possibility of expressing negative stuff. It's not acceptable to the caregiver. It's one of the conditions that causes people to become dismissing. So everything has to be idealized. Everything has to be presented in an ideal light. The child, in some sense, knows that the idealized version is not really what's happening, but it's a currency. So they present themselves and the environment in an ideal way, and then the caregiver takes care of them in the way that the caregiver takes care of them. It isn't really based on their essential need. It's based on the appearance of it. But the child learns that if I present ideally in this way, I can get that. And so it's transaction. But the child never has to really produce anything beyond the idealization. And so they also learn that in presenting the idealization, I've completed my end of the deal. I tell the caregiver what they want. They give me what I want, and that's the complete deal. Now, they size you up and figure out what it is that you want to hear, and then they tell you what you want to hear, and then you give them what they want. And for them, that's a complete deal. But if they were telling you that they were going to do things for you, and that's what meant something to you, you've been fooled, because they're complete when you give them what they want, because they've said that they are going to do it. Is that making sense? I'll show up at 9 a.m. tomorrow, and then they don't show up. And you're really upset about that, and they're confused by that, because they told you that they would be there, which is what you wanted. And you try to explain to them, no, actually what I wanted you to do was show up. But this doesn't really compute in their understanding of the world, because in their childhood experience and where they learned to negotiate these things, it was simply saying what you wanted. Is that making sense? That's different than pretending. Now I think it's not so clear. In a dismissing person, they're working off the model that they create internally of self and world, self and other. And so they're operating on that basis. The preoccupied mind is engaged in the mind state of the other and is determining what they think the other person wants and pretending to be that. So in one, the internal working model is the representation, and they're operating on that basis. Whereas with the preoccupied person, they're really externally focused and engaged in the mind state of the other person. Is that helping? Dismissing people don't like to be alone, and they have an acute abandonment terror. But they don't experience it as fearfulness of being abandoned. They experience it as being rejected. So the dismissing person is constantly interpreting experiences in the relationship as rejecting and requiring reassurance that you're not rejecting. And the way that they do that mostly is they seduce you by telling you what you want to hear. And as soon as they feel you coming toward them, they begin to withdraw from you. Because as long as you're actively pursuing them, they feel that they can't be abandoned. It relieves that abandonment tear. But if you stop and you demand things in the relationship, demand that they're actually responsible for what they say they're going to do, that creates the experience of anxiety. And then they have a tendency to look for alternative relationships that they can bail onto if you actually make a demand that they're not willing to meet. Occupied people don't do that. They really pursue, then they pursue, and they pursue until they're actually burning out and can't do it anymore. Then they make a stand about it. The dismissing person moves on because they can't bear that. And it's often with breathtaking speed that they move on to somebody else, and that there was somebody else in the wings to move on to is also mind-blowing to a lot of people in relationship to them. And it creates the perception that the relationship wasn't real and that they never cared. But this isn't also true. They do care, but the constellation that they experience of the falling into the terrible sadness at the core, they can't really do. And so they move on to somebody else who will participate in the care that they need. Christian?
So to sort of contrast the kind of blow up, it sounds like the preoccupied person has a buildup of resentment for things that they agreed to and have been doing without ever expressing that they didn't want to do those things. And that comes to a head and then they get out. And then the dismissive person gets out because
they make a stand. And they threaten to leave.
That's the preoccupied?
The preoccupied person makes a stand and they threaten to leave if the dismissing person does not change what they're doing and finally address the needs that they have. The dismissing person, of course, is unwilling to do any of that. And so they leave. The preoccupied person is leaving in the grand gesture of leaving, but they're really hoping that the dismissing person will grab them and prevent them from going in the grand gesture. And sometimes if they're a really good caregiver and the ask is not too much, the dismissing person will do it for a while to get the relationship to go back to the other terms. So you'll often see they flip from the withdrawing person into the seducing person, re-seduce the preoccupied person, and as soon as they're convinced that they're hooked again, they flip back into the withdrawal, and the preoccupied person then pursues. But if the preoccupied person were to hold their ground, the dismissing person would likely bail. They don't reciprocate, and if you demand of them that they reciprocate, they won't do it. It really does affect the entire working model of the world that they have. Unless they do something to change their attachment conditioning, which they can do, and actually they have all the skills that you need to adjust attachment into something more collaborative. In the early conditioning of that, we're all born autoregulators. And if somebody comes reliably enough that we're willing to reorient toward external regulation, we do that. But dismissing people don't have that experience. That didn't happen for them. Nobody came reliably enough that they reoriented. So they've always been autoregulators. They've always been self-contained in that way. Preoccupied people have unreliable care, but it's still good enough that the kids reorient toward the caregiver, but then they become dependent on the emotional regulation of the caregiver. They can't leave, and so they don't develop exploration. It's only in the secure dynamic where the caregiver comes reliably enough that the child can feel a sense of safety and begin to collaborate in the way that they're taken care of. So they express themselves authentically, the caregivers sensitively attunes to them, empathetically connects to them, understands what it is that they need, mirrors that back to them, and takes care of them. So the child learns that if I express myself authentically in this way, I elicit that care. And that's the process of learning security. So as adults, even if we didn't grow up in that, if we can see our caregivers and understand the nature of their lives and why they responded the way that they did to us, we can begin to identify what it is that they actually could offer us now in the adult relationship. And that if we can accept that and have the needs that they are actually able to meet met, there's a sense of love and care that grows from that, which for all of us is an essential thing. Particularly if we had little of it when we were growing up, it can bear quite a bit of meaning. Not if you had sadistic care. This doesn't apply to anybody who had sadistic care. Just the hapless care that often happens. Then you have to identify what your needs actually are. You know, when you're a kid and your needs aren't reflected back to you, or they're reflected back to you in a negative way, we often don't understand what that would be or what it would feel like if those needs were met. And that's part of this coming into peace with the family system, is understanding what we need and then going out into the world and finding reliable people who will meet those needs. So we're not in a state of deficit. That when we're in a state of deficit and we go back to the family system and we continue to look for them to meet those needs without recognizing that they can't do it, we're always in a state of deprivation and always in a state of anger with them for causing the deprivation. So to see them clearly, see what they have to offer, what they don't have to offer, get those needs met that they can't meet with other people who will meet them, and then be with them the way that they are and appreciate who they are. And that opens up that whole piece of the things that they were able to do for us that actually did have some meaning for us. Is that making sense? And then to enjoy it from this place of abundance, because we've actually put together a social world that takes care of us and supports and encourages us. That's what we need, that secure base to explore from, and not the insecure base that so many of us grew up with in the family system. And then organize the time, energy, and resources that you flow into those relationships so that it's commensurate with what you're getting out of it. I know that it's not necessarily thought of as a good way to think about these things, but I think in adult relationships, really the usefulness of the relationship needs to be understood so that the time, energy, and resources that you flow into the relationship make sense, that you're not depleted from relationships that don't actually provide enough support, that you're in a state of deprivation. Some relationships require so much time, energy, and resources to keep the relationship functioning that it doesn't leave you the time, energy, and resources to get all of your needs met. So then you're in addition to that in a state of deprivation. Really, if you consider relationships at all levels as being instrumental to supporting the exploration for meaning, then that is a good way to organize things. And that includes the relationship to the caregiver and the family. How does that fit into your ability to explore for meaning. Of course, part of this cycle of finding meaning is the people that you're expressing and able to express to the things that you're finding out, the meaning that you're finding out. That's part of the cycle. And so if you can include your family system into that, it can be quite rewarding. One of the things about us is that our one of the ways that we know about ourselves and one of the ways that we integrate the experiences that we've had, particularly as you get older, is the witnesses to your life, which is these relationships. And these some of these relationships can get quite long. I remember when my grandmother was 90 or so, she said, I just don't know anybody anymore. And I said, what are you talking about? You have all of these friends. And I listed off this list of people that I had encountered that she had introduced me to. She was a big bridge player and she played often. And she was she grew orchids and was involved in the Orchid Society. She was a big gardener. She was involved in the garden clubs. She said, oh, those people, I've only known those people for 10 years. I used to know people for 70. So that piece of these relationships that go on for a long time and the reflection of yourself in the eyes of people that have known you. I mean, I'm not that old, but I do have relationships that are, you know, 45 years long, which is the reflection of that, what you were like and what you are now. It's hard to notice that. You know, the self experience is always presenting you as this continuous, ongoing, unchanging being. But when you have the reflected experience of people who've known you that long, it's quite quite meaningful, I think. Their experiences of the way in which you engage and the meaning you found and how that contributes to the richness of life is quite something. That making sense? One of the things about attachment conditioning, of course, is it starts so early and it's operational so early before the conscious self experience. And because it is so pernicious in the way that it affects the way that you create the reality that you experience, you're used to seeing the distortions. If you don't consider them, you often can think that they're true because they've always been there. They preceded your conscious self-experience. And they really do affect the way in which you form relationships. So examining that and really having a sense of it and then developing the skills that you need so that you can be more flexible and more collaborative in relationships is essential to changing it. And all of that is really pretty doable. If you have the chance to repair the relationships with your family systems, because of the nature of the human conditioning, the meaningfulness of that, it's totally worth doing. Even if they don't change so much, your ability to see them clearly and be in relationship in a way that's actually meaningful to you will help with that. And then if they're harming, which is sometimes true, that may not be available to you. And so that's also something to consider. Sadistic caregiver is probably somebody you don't want to reconnect to. But that won't mean necessarily that everybody in the family system is that, and that some relationships might be repairable. we did start with the concept of estrangement, and sometimes that's the better choice. So there's this whole spectrum. How's that? Shall we do some heart practice? Maybe some loving kindness? We can start with an easy person and then work with friends and family. So go ahead and take your meditation posture. All right, let go of the meditation. So how did that go? Good. Saturday is the second. Oh, Christian?
Maybe this is too big of a question for the end, but in terms of like when you get into like a jhana or something, you have a physical thing to concentrate on. But in this, maybe this is too philosophical, in the sense that all of my experience is mediated through this physical sensory world. What's the physical part before that that I'm actually concentrating on? If does my question make sense?
So with loving kindness, when you hold a particular view, it changes the way you perceive things. It isn't just the visual sphere that changes; all sense gates are affected by it. So that the whole way of experiencing the present moment shifts. When you get used to pulling up the mind state and the appearance of things, it doesn't matter whether the eyes are open or not, because you recognize the pattern of that particular view. Mm-hmm. As you concentrate, because you're working with view and that often is, you know, centered up here, there's a contractive energy that forms sort of at the front of the forehead. And that's the physical sensation that you're looking for, that you use as a marker. So you're holding the marker of it, but at the same time experiencing the perception of the body and mind in the view of loving kindness.
Okay. So you don't believe that there isn't like a little hidden seed of self-generated emotion that's actually powering this?
It doesn't matter what the emotions are that you're experiencing, because everything is distorted by the view.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be experiencing anger through the view and it would be different.
Okay.
The most common description of people experiencing that is, I'm getting a headache from doing this, because it's a kind of contractive energy in the front of the head. But then the headache goes away as soon as you stop the practice. So it isn't actually a headache, it's the energy of it. And then it can get quite intense, the way that PT can get quite intense. Rather than it being an expansive, it's a contractive energy, but PT is often contractive. You settle into one-pointedness because your mind doesn't move off the energy of it. That's one of the ways that you're just abiding without having to effort so hard to do it. And then as you do that for longer and longer periods, of course, there's a lag with the view that doesn't dissolve right away. And so your perception is inclining toward that perception. My experience of it mainly, if I were to describe it, is everybody and everything becomes quite beautiful in a way that you don't normally think of things being like that. So you're wandering around and everything is beautiful. It's obviously a view and not an equanimous mind, because in an equanimous mind, it doesn't look like that. It's not experienced like that. But I've got easily into jhana, so you guys are really beautiful.
Even moisturizing.
Are you in LA, Jade, or are you back in London?
I'm in LA through like March. So
I sent you a text about dinner, but you didn't respond. So I'm thinking that maybe you didn't get it.
I didn't. So I'll email you my number.
Okay. Because it's a 717 number. Is that your old number or something?
No, that's me. It's from Lancaster in Pennsylvania. But I didn't get your text, which is curious. So,
All right. Is everybody good? Saturday is the second of the level one day longs that we're doing for March. We're going to start a level two in January. I think that there is a Friday night how to date like a secure person thing happening this month as well. Let's see if I can find it. I don't know when it is, but it's maybe the 21st. No, the 22nd. See if it's on the website. And I think that's everything that's coming up in the next little bit.
We're just on the 15th.
The 15th. Okay. That was a fun evening. So it's a nice dialogue to have. Appreciate your practice. Thanks for coming. If you're resourced and can make a donation, I'll also appreciate that. There's a link on the website. But your practice is also enough. Thank you for coming. We'll see you soon. Bye.